EWA-517, do you want to report a UFO? Over.
Negative. We don't want to report.
Ares 31, do you wish to report a UFO? Over.
Negative. We won't report one of those either.
Ares 31, do you wish to file a report of any kind? Over.
I wouldn't know what kind of report to file, sir.
Ares 31, me neither.
There 71 Papa Golf, go ahead.
And was there anybody at above us that passed us like 30 seconds ago?
There 71 Papa Golf, negative.
Okay. Stop this. It's a UFO.
Yeah. Hey, it's Merger 295. Yeah, something just passed over. Don't know what it was, but it's at least 2,000-3,000 feet above us. Yeah, it passed right over the top of us.
911.
You guys busy? Do we just call about the UFOs we saw?
Mm-hmm.
They're out there, taking airplanes.
And a dispatch. Bob, I swear to God, 4 calls in on an unidentified object over Liberty.
4 calls.
4 calls on an unidentified flying object.
Let's not take a look. All right, we'll check it out.
Welcome to UFO Chronicles, a place where people share their experiences of the strange and unexplained. If you've had an encounter and would like to be on the show, you can email me at ufochronicles@gmail.com.
Hello everyone and welcome to the show wherever in the world you are listening from. How are you all? We start off this episode with a witness submission from Sergio in Portugal and a vision he had on the morning of September the 11th, 2001. Then we hear from Minty in Australia about her paranormal experiences on her travels in Colombia, Ireland, China and Australia. If you enjoy listening to the podcast and would like to help support my work, there is a couple of ways to do this. Either you can join Patreon and become a patron of the show for as little as $5 a month, or you can donate via PayPal. And if you like, you can set up monthly reoccurring payments. All links to support the podcast are below in the show notes and on the website. Any help is extremely appreciated, and it helps the show to continue running. Now, on with the show.
Sergio, and here goes my story. On 11th of September 2001, I was going to work around 8:30 in the morning by train. I had to drive, I had to go to our city by train. It was about 45 minutes distance. At 8:30 in the morning, I was sitting by the window on the train, and the sun came up and just hit me in the face. And then I had a strange vision of a Phantom F4 fighter going against the Statue of Liberty in New York. I said to me, well, that's a strange idea, that's a stupid thought. Then I continue on my way to work. At around 12:30 or around 1 p.m. local time, our local time, I was told by a colleague of mine that a plane went against the towers in New York. And I immediately recalled the vision or the thing that came up to my mind a few hours ago. It was September 11, 2001. And what I found strange is that I had that vision, let's call it vision, 5 hours before the planes hit the Twin Towers. I live in Portugal, Lisbon, and the time zone difference is around 5 hours to New York. It was a strange coincidence. That idea I had, that it was not any, I saw the plane, you should call it a vision, well, we can call it a vision, because I saw the plane going against the Statue of Liberty, Phantom F4, Vietnam fighter period, like something telling me that a U.S. Plane went against their most known statue all over the world. And that's it. That's my story of September 11, 2001. That happened to me, and it's personal. So have a nice evening. Bye.
Hello, Mimti. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Nick. It's lovely to be on the show.
And it's great to have you with us. And you're calling from Brisbane, Australia.
Yes, a little bit chilly at the moment.
Brisbane is a lovely part of the world. Now, you have some paranormal experiences. Would you like to start at the beginning, please, ma'am?
So, years ago, it was probably about 2004, I was living with my daughter and my husband high up in the Andes, above Bogota, which is the capital of Colombia. So Bogota is about 10 million people, and it's at 2,600 meters above sea level. So it's, you know, it's quite high, and people who visit the city often get altitude sickness. Well, where we were living was another 600 odd meters above that, so right in the Andes, in what they call the cloud forest above Bogota. So about 3,200 meters, quite cold, quite chilled atmosphere, but quite pure as well because you're quite high up, and with higher altitudes you get a crisper atmosphere. Very beautiful up in that part of the Andes because it's still fairly forested and with original forests as well. Now, I won't mention the name of where we lived because it might identify what I'm about to tell you, and I'd rather not do that. And you'll understand by the end of the story as to why I don't want to do that. So living in this area above Bogota was free of all that reflective glow from a very large city. It was quite glorious at night, and you could appreciate the brilliance of stars, and the sky was often clear of cloud. And there were mountains all around, and sometimes you would get these incredible electrical storms doing a 360 around you as you watch them. So up in this area, my daughter was still going to high school at the time, so I'd often walk or drive to the main part, to the main road, which is where the Conjunto or gated community started. And, you know, you'd talk to people or pick up people along the way who needed a lift, and they'd reciprocate the favour, and it was a nice community. All sorts of different people living there. So the properties were quite large, and that was how you got to know people. So there was one particular neighbour, Amparo, an elderly woman, who didn't own a car. She didn't own pretty much anything. She lived in a very tiny house with her small head of dairy cattle, which she milked every day. And she was a minimalist. She always said, you know, what I don't have, I don't need. She always wore a ruana or poncho with gumboots and kind of a beanie on her head. And when she needed something, she'd hitch into town. And we were often the only ones who picked her up because she was a bit smelly because she smelled like cow's milk, old cow's milk, because she was a milk lady. Yeah. So we'd chat to her. Now, she owned very large swathes of one side of the mountain, and on the other side of the mountain was her sister who owned the other side. So this area was what you call the cloud forest in that area. So a section of the mountain, the really high part, was ancient forest, and usually completely covered in clouds, so you could barely see it. Beautiful area. So remembering we're up at 3,200 metres and it's quite chilly and it's very steep, this was the environment that we were living in, very beautiful. We had saved a local dog from a dog attack. His name was Caliche. Now, he belonged to someone else. We don't know who they were, but he became very loyal to us because we looked after him and saved him. Now, he was a bit of a little demon. He was a black dog, quite demonic. He had dark, cold eyes, but he loved us and he followed us everywhere. And his companion, Simon, another male dog used to come too. So we'd often wander around Amparo's property. She let us do that and throw sticks in the local dams and, you know, pick flowers and roll down hills and, you know, just enjoy the environment. And we'd often go to the local quarry where over centuries, essentially, people had quarried stone for their houses. So up around the quarry was always a beautiful spot to watch storms or the brilliance of the stars at night, or to watch the clouds kind of fleet over the top of the Andes where we were living. So the dogs weren't keen on the top of the quarry. They never came with us at night. They'd sit further down and wait for us to come back. One night, our usual visit to the quarry, we were blind struck by this light high up past Amparo's house at the edge of the cow paddocks, where the cow paddocks met the cloud forest, essentially. There was a light. Now, this light was enormous. It's like a stadium light, like a bunch of halogen lights, huge and strong. Now, there were no roads up there. There was, you know, even Amparo's house didn't have a roadway to her house. She walked through the paddocks. There were no roads up there. There was no way any kind of construction light could have gone up there, and for what purpose anyway? It was private property. So this light was huge. It blew our minds. What is that light? Up there in a cow paddock below the cloud forest, what was it? The first night we saw it, my husband, Hernan, who is Colombian born and knows the stories, realized what the light was. Now, they say that the Muisca, or indigenous people of the Andes, Chibcha, Muisca, have allowed the light to appear to people to advertise the presence of treasures. Now, because the Spaniards came and slaughtered so many people, the Muisca and the Chibcha, the main gold production tribes of the Andes, and they still exist, they're still around, they buried a lot of their treasures, gold, gems, ceremonial treasures. They put them in pots usually, so ceramic type pots, about the size of, I don't know, like a kitchen bin, like you would have a small kitchen bin, and they would seal them and then bury them to avoid the Spaniards stealing them. They did. So they'd bury them in really dangerous places or not so obvious places or places where people just wouldn't want to go. And usually on top of them, they would put a heavy stone, usually very flattened, very smooth, and with a mark or a word engraved in one of the corners. So this is what is known as the huaca. The huaca is a receptacle which holds all of these treasures. And these are genuine things. Now, national Colombian law has protected these antiquities, pre-Columbian antiquities. But of course, there's always people who want to steal, essentially, right? So they become so valuable over time. Finding a huaca can make you a millionaire tomorrow. So did you get century after century of huaqueros, or antiquity thieves or robbers, who have gained huge wealth hunting them down? So to be a huaquero, you need to be pretty brave and to understand how to locate these things. So huaqueros, they visit small towns and they ask around if anyone's seen strange lights or unusual things have happened, and then they follow that. And then, of course, they plunder these pre-Columbian artifacts and sell them on the black market. A lot of people willing to pay for these things illegally and internationally. So Renan, my husband, said, you know, this light is the light of the huaca. The Muisca people are telling us that there's a huaca here. And we said nothing, of course, because to even speak about that sort of thing in public to friends or huaqueros who would defile the place, if you see what I mean. So it was every night for weeks we watched the same bright light from the top of the quarry, you know, marvelling at how could that get it? That's ridiculous. How could that happen up there in a cow paddock? And then finally curiosity got the best of us and we thought maybe during daylight hours we should go have a look. Just out of curiosity. So we grabbed a bottle of water, we set up Paro's steeply inclined paddocks, and Kalich and Simon, the two dogs, of course, came with us because they were always ready to walk with us. And then when we reached the tree line above Amparo's tiny little one-room cottage, we stopped to have a look at the valley below, the valley of beyond. And there were so many wildflowers in the grass, and two enormous old pine trees stood really, really tall as if guarding the entrance to this ancient forest we were about to enter, this cloud forest, which was above the sky in a way. So we ventured into this really thick forest, and then we quickly, it became quite confusing and disorienting. It's almost as if the ground and trees merged into one mass, and there was not much to distinguish sky from earth, and we were clambering upwards, and at some point, we couldn't walk anymore. We had to crawl. So the moss was so thick beneath our feet. It was spongy and interwoven with lichen and resembled kind of an old man's beard. It was beautiful and soft. And our daughter was the first one to notice the depth of the moss. So she pointed to where her foot had trodden and the moss breathed itself back into place. Then we noticed as we're crawling up into this ancient forest, that the dogs were whimpering. We turned around just in time to see Simon, the younger one, heading off back down the hill, leaving the forest. So then we're kind of struck. Okay, we're walking, crawling into this kind of overly enormous ancient forest, and everything was interwoven branches, and it hit us that we weren't really on Earth anymore. We had left Earth in the sense of dirt and soil. We'd left Earth behind and we were kind of suspended inside this web of trees and tree branches which had created their own forest floor, and in between the spaces of the branches was this incredibly thick and spongy moss. So we still had Caliche with us, you know, the old demonic dog was still with us, but he definitely wasn't comfortable. So we sat down on, you know, this heavy mat of lichen and moss to share a bottle of water, and we leant against the bole of an enormous old tree trunk. It was dark and kind of smooth and shiny, and there were elevated roots thrusting outwards from this kind of fake forest floor, this mossy floor, and different colours that were glistening with, you know, this constant moisture from the clouds. And we found ourselves speaking very quietly. It's almost like the forest, this ancient forest, consumed the sound. So Caliche was really anxious, and we gave him some water, but he wouldn't drink. And then without warning, which put chills up us, Caliche let out sudden howl, long howl, and we froze. Before we could look at each other, Caliche had gone. He'd just run. And so it was at that point where we agreed, okay, it's a good time to leave. So we were pushing ourselves up, and as I pushed myself up to go, my hand entered a space in the mossy floor at the base of this tree, at the bole of the tree. And then there was a cold sensation on my hand, and it felt like stone. So my husband and daughter noticed it. So they crawled back to have a look, and we were whispering at this stage. And then there was this rush of excitement. It hit us all. Maybe this was actually a waka. Maybe we had found something. Maybe we had found ancient Muisca treasure. So we all stirred up and hung about the small opening at the base of this tree. And Renan pulled away a little bit of moss and exposed the corner of a stone, and it was a smooth stone. It was smooth and the edges were squarish, and there was a mark of a triangle etched in the upright right-hand corner of the stone. So it hit us. And then the fact that this was more likely a waka actually terrified me. Even telling the tale now, kind of, I get that fear in me that we were on the verge of doing something very wrong. And then from down in the valley, as if a second warning was coming through, Kariche, the dog, was howling. We could hear him howling as if to say, leave now. So without thinking, I just knew that to move the waka, to move the stone, to do anything there would be to defile the muisca law of the area and would bring about ruination and unhappiness, I think, to everyone around us. Now, that is part of the waka tale. If you talk to Colombians, they will say anyone who's found a waka, their life is a misery afterwards because they defiled the indigenous ground. They should have left it rest. The huaqueros, you know, you hear stories of famous huaqueros or antiquity thieves who, you know, make a massive fortune very quickly and then die tragically in some, you know, unexplained accident. So the story, you know, my feeling, my sense of unease about even thinking about moving that stone was backed by, you know, centuries of stories about ruination if you touch the waka of the indigenous people. So there was a real panic in me, you know, and I was like the dog. I yelled out in a way, howling, no, we can't do this. And then there was this toing and froing, a bit like the conquistadors probably had, this toing and froing about whether the light, seeing the light, had given us the right to take the treasure that was lying there. And if we didn't take it now, then maybe the huaqueros would come and they would take it and then it would all be over. But to me, the voice in my mind that was coming clearly through was the voice of the Muisca people. They were saying, the elders in my head were saying, leave the waka in place, leave it there. So in a way, at the end of the day, we didn't become millionaires. We left it. And the Muisca won, and we never returned to that forest. And when we left that area, Amparo was still the guardian of the mountain, and we've been very happy and we're doing well without it. And I don't know what would have happened if we'd opened up that hole and taken that pot of treasures. I only know that same day, that night of that same day, the light never shone again. We never saw it again. And so the waka, I think, hopefully, and I pray that the waka, the treasures of the Muisca people, is still there and hidden from the greed of men, in a way.
Wow, that was like an adventure, that was.
It was, yes. And I feel very privileged to have seen it and to have been part of something like that.
It makes you wonder that when people do see strange lights in the area, they don't talk about them because they're worried that the antiquity thieves would want to pick apart the area.
Yeah, and this is centuries old tradition in Colombia that if you do see something, you don't speak about it. Unless you're about want to join, you know, the den of robbers and make money out of it. But most people know it's prohibited in a way to touch them. So you've got three elements. You've got, you know, those promise of riches, but also this sort of fear of disaster that will follow. Plus, you've got national Colombian laws which prohibit you taking indigenous treasures and certainly not selling them. They have to be returned to the government and returned to the indigenous people. So there's no way you can benefit financially from this anyway. And the stories are so strong about ruination that people will not mention the fact that they've seen unusual things for fear of it either bringing the huaqueros, the thieves, there, or, you know, bringing disaster on themselves. Yeah.
So we certainly understand why you'd not want to give the location away. And anyone who's thinking about emailing me to try and get the location, don't bother. Mimti's lips are sealed.
Thank you, Nick. You're protecting the whisker treasure.
It's too risky. It's too risky. I suppose people do go after it, not believing in the superstition and stuff. So, but it's just not worth it, is it? Money isn't everything.
No, and you know there are catalogues of stories about people who've done such things, and you know disaster strikes them. So at the end of the day, you probably don't have enough time to enjoy your treasures anyway, because you know death and destruction is just around the corner.
It's like the old Egyptian curses, isn't it? Open up the tombs.
It very much is. And if you do read some of the chronicles of you know famous vaqueros or antiquity thieves, you know their lives are very troubled.
So do you think they were, the lights were telling you to go there?
Yes, and that's very much part of, you know, Colombian indigenous history. If you see the lights, I guess you've got two choices. That is to protect and defend, and the other is to steal and lose in a way. And again, this is chronicled through, you know, many people's stories. After this all happened to us, I started to read up on the stories of, you know, huacas and lights, especially the lights that people are shown in a way by Indigenous ancestors. Yeah, a bit like Min Min lights, I guess, in Australia, which you've probably heard of.
Of course, yeah.
There's different theories about those as well.
It could be like a test then.
Yeah, yeah. They say that that intense light, you know, like the lights we had seen, are very much associated with Indigenous law, so especially in Colombia. And I guess, you know, in a way it kind of makes sense. You know, it's almost like the ancestors returning to give you this kind of divine choice. Which way will you go? The test.
The test. Well, you certainly did the right thing. That's fascinating, as I'm going to look into that. That's really interesting. Introducing the High Strangeness Coffee Blend by Redacted Coffee Company, a medium roast of the Brazilian kind. This medium roast offers flavors of chocolate and vanilla combined with a distinct fruity taste and a unique sweet floral aroma. The experience of high strangeness doesn't end there, with a sweet butter aftertaste that doesn't fade as your coffee cools. This coffee regains its flavors all the way through your cup, ensuring it truly is good to the last drop. The veteran-funded, employee-owned Redacted Coffee Company and UFO Chronicles podcast have partnered together to bring you the best coffee on and off the planet. Get 20% off your first order now at redactedcoffee.com/UFO. That's redactedcoffee.com/UFO. Or follow the link below in this episode's description or click on the banner of my website. This podcast is fueled by coffee oozing high strangeness. So what are you waiting for? Wake up to the strange. Okay, Mimti, where are you going to take us next?
Oh, I'd love to take you to China. I lived in China for a bit too. So, yeah, if you don't mind, Nick, that'd be lovely.
Yep, that'd be great. Across to the Orient.
So the first time I was in China, I lived there in 1980. So it's a long time ago. And especially at that time, we have to remember it only had been 4 years since Mao Zedong had died. So the country back then wasn't the country that we know of today, you know, very advanced today. And, you know, there's very little poverty, a lot of, you know, very big middle class. But in the days that I was there initially in 1980, it was a very different place. And it was a lot of poverty and a lot of, you know, a lot of communes. People certainly didn't have private property at that time. That came about 1985, the changes. So when I was traveling around a bit, I decided I wanted to go to the birthplace of Confucius. So Confucius was a real person, of course, and he was born and he died and is buried in a place called Chufu. His tomb is often really a place of veneration, and it's located in the forest of the Kong family, who were part of a dynastic family at that period. So you can walk through these beautiful sprawling gardens and see the Kong family monuments and cemetery. But you see, in post-Mao China in 1980, I was an unusual sight because there weren't many foreigners in China. And back then, Chufu wasn't a big town like it is today, a big city. It was really a village. And I went to see this famous tomb, and I stayed in the only accommodation, which was extremely restricted to foreigners, the only accommodation available to foreigners, which is the Kungfu Mansion, and that's several streets away from the main area. So I stayed in the older section of the Ming Dynasty section. Now, if I can paint a picture of Chufu in those days, you know, people had bicycles, there were no cars, and people would put mats of corn and stuff, you know, grains out on the street and then ride their carts over them to crush it. So it was milled on the street and, you know, things were very, very basic. So for a foreigner like me to be in the middle of this village was quite unusual. But there I was in this very run-down Ming Dynasty mansions belonging to the Kong family, and the gardens had gone wild, and there was a large tilled area out in the gardens where someone was actually planting out corn and vegetables to grow. So in the evening, there was only me and a Canadian guy who was taking dinner in the enormous dining hall. You can imagine a very large, wealthy Ming Dynasty family had a huge dining hall. So there we were, the two of us, having dinner in this huge dining hall from the vegetables that had been grown in the overgrown courtyard. So the courtyard was enormous. It took several minutes to cross it. And the chef, who was also the dishwasher and everything else, gave me that night, because it was cold, a small alcohol-fueled lantern to get me back to my room across the way. So the room itself had very little alteration over the centuries, merely probably just to patch up leaks and hang up communist posters. The floors of the Ming Dynasty never actually met the wall. So there's always a gap between the floor and the wall in Ming Dynasty rooms. And it's a very uniquely Chinese design. It allows really easy cleaning by flooding or sweeping stuff out from the stone floor with water and sweeping it out onto the stone drains into the courtyard. So you've always got this gap between the walls. So you can imagine in winter it's quite cold. My room was tiny, with just enough space for a single bed and a night table. Where I put my lantern and a tiny travelling clock, which I always carried with me. So it was winter and freezing. There was snow falling every night, and it floated into the room through these spaces between the wall and the floor. And my feather quilts, you know, did the job. I slept really well, but I was awoken, I don't know what time it was, by the sound of footsteps and voices. I kind of, you know, woke myself up. These voices were whispering. There were soft footsteps on the stones outside my door. And I sat up in bed and I saw in the space between the wall and the floor, I got out of bed to have a look, the feet of people passing, because I thought, a lot of people, where have they all come from? Maybe I should open the door. And I was a little bit scared. Well, I'm on my own. What should I do? So there was, I could see the feet of people passing, but there were lights. And there were shadows and flickering lights, as if it was a lantern. They were carrying lanterns and possibly not modern ones. So then I noticed the feet and I was blown away. I kind of really leapt out of bed at this point, you know, threw everything back, got on my knees and looked upside down to see whose feet, to which people did these feet belong? It was such a solitary place I was staying at this time of night, and it was freezing. Who were they? Then I realised the feet were beautifully shoed, elaborate shoes, very fine embroidery reminiscent of the Ming Dynasty. And I knew my Chinese history. That's why I was there. I was studying Ming and Qing paintings in the galleries around Shanghai and Beijing. But the feet were so small. And here's the trick. They were bound feet, and that meant women of wealth, and that meant not women of the communist period. So so the period before or even before that. So these were not the feet of living people. The hems of their gowns were richly embroidered with gilt edging and pink peonies, flowers, and their voices were hushed and they laughed lightly as if they were talking about something that had happened in the main hall or during that night, or perhaps they were going to meet illicit lovers, I don't know. But their Chinese words were ancient, and I knew because in that point in time I was fluent in Mandarin, and the way they spoke was ancient, the words they were using, and they were so hushed. Everything was hushed, and the lanterns were flickering and they were gone. So I was still kind of hanging upside down on my knees, looking through this space between the wall and the floors, the stone floors, with this drift of snow coming in. And I was shocked. And it hit me. And then it hit me hard that I had just been privy to apparitions from 400 years ago, or maybe even more, from the style of their shoe and the style of their dress. And I was shocked more than frightened, because I looked over at my clock face and I crawled over to have a look and saw the time. It was 3:03 in the morning. And it chilled me then. It hit me, the cold. I was out of bed with hardly anything on. I leapt back into bed, and then, of course, I woke up long after dawn. But then, how did I explain this? I don't know how I explained it. So I took breakfast in the main hall and the Canadian had left, and I tossed up the idea of whether I should ask the, you know, chef who was also the dishwasher or anyone else who lived there to clean, who was cleaning the rooms, had they ever heard or seen of anything unusual in the courtyards. So I thought, oh, well, this is during the communist period. Maybe I should be very careful what I say. It would be a difficult question to ask people who were generally pretty guarded, especially around foreigners, and maybe I shouldn't say anything, but I did. And then the chef dishwasher, he laughed out loud, and he smiled at me with that kind of smile, and he said to me, "We get so many visitors," just like that. So that was an obtuse way of saying, yes, I know what you saw. So other people had seen them. It wasn't my imagination. And when I think now, you know, I've been to Chufu since, it's a very changed place. You know, they've pulled down the mansions. The hotels and the fancy restaurants are still there. I'd still like to think that those Ming women, you know, those wealthy women from the court of the Kong family, were still wandering around the compound somewhere there, whispering and gossiping in the early hours of the morning, and the lights sputtering around in the cold winds. That's what I'd like to think. They're still there.
That is an amazing experience. That is wonderful to be privy to something like that.
I was very lucky.
Of course, they stopped bounding the feet long time ago.
Yes, and I think from the start, because I had been studying Chinese Qing and Ming Dynasty art, I had been able to kind of peg the period that the, you know, the design of the flowers, the gold around the shoes and the hems of their dresses was possibly Ming, yeah, and blown away. I'm so lucky. And again, you know, I apparitions, and I've had lots of experiences that don't scare me, because, you know, it's a privilege to be able to see things like this and to be able to tell the tale, you know. I'm very lucky.
And this was in 1980.
Yeah, a long time ago now.
1980, yes. Of course, it's a very different place now. I never managed to get to China. I've been to Hong Kong, but never China. I have always wanted to go, though.
It's a wonderful country, and I've been lucky enough to go many times and see how it's changed over those times. I mean, the Chufu of today, the city, is a city now. There's no way you would see any of that. I just hope the, you know, the spirits are still around there and wandering somewhere, maybe in the cemetery for where Confucius is buried.
Yeah, I'm sure that the ladies are still wandering around and gossiping. That's wonderful.
They did make me smile. They did make me smile.
We did say we get visitors.
Yes, like it was nothing. Yeah, so for me, it is a very Chinese way of speaking. It wasn't a direct yes, but it was a confirmation, you know, an affirmation that, yes, they're here.
Yeah, you said it all. That's wonderful. Oh, thank you for that. Love that one. Are we going to go to the Emerald Isle next?
Oh, you want to go to Ireland?
We sure do. We have lots of listeners in Ireland.
Oh, terrific. Yes. Okay. Now, this one, this particular event happened in Newgrange. I don't know if people know much about Newgrange, but it's an ancient site in Ireland, and it's often associated with burial riches, rituals that I guess has really, it's a bit contentious. You know, when people talk about Newgrange, there's a whole lot of archaeology, one side of archaeology that says, yes, it's a burial site. But as we know from, you know, the rethinking of archaeology, it may not have been. It may have been something quite different, as they're discovering about many ancient sites around the world. So this is in Northeast Ireland, like the Republic of Ireland, an amazing site. It's older than the Egyptian pyramids, and its design indicates really it was a product of a highly sophisticated and really cohesive society. Other than that, not much else is known. What we do know, I think, is really speculative. It's not, I don't think we know anything for sure. And I wish in a way that some spirits had visited me there, but in a way they kind of did. So I was with my sister and my daughter, and we were traveling around Ireland in the 1990s. We were determined to see Newgrange. You know, I'm determined to see ancient sites wherever I am. So the site itself is physically spectacular when you see it. There's a high mound over a long sloping grassy field. And then at the top of it is this incredible construction, which is also covered in grass. So the roof of this is covered in grass. So you've got this sloping mound to this incredible rock and stone round circular construction, which is then covered in grass. So it's then hedged. The whole area is hedged by the rowan tree, and it's been carefully topiaried over time into box hedges and then interconnected, and there's high wooden fences, and that's where the break in the rowan tree hedges actually occurs. You can walk through into the site. And as you know, the rowan is a sacred tree to the ancients of Northern Europe, and it's spectacularly ordinary in a way. It's an evergreen tree, but it has small maroon-coloured fruit that's shaped a little bit like miniature apples that grow on it in summer. And we were there in summer. And I'd read a lot of the laws of Northern Europe, and I was aware that of the rowan tree's power, and thinking this, I thought, oh, beauty, you know, being a dreadful Australian, I plucked off three of the berries and I put them into the deepest pocket in my heavy jacket. And I think that was my first mistake, one thing I shouldn't have done. The second one was then to go on to onto the compulsory cultural tour, and then there is a small group of eight people are escorted into the main chamber of Newgrange, which is deep inside this, you know, stone construction. The guide was really lovely, and they told the story of, you know, the current theory about the place. But as we walked further into the chamber, which slopes downwards at a slight angle, it slopes downwards and it catches the light from the entrance. And so at one point, the light from the front entrance disappears, and then the guide has to turn on sort of miniature lights to line our way into the core of this, you know, what they claim is a burial chamber. And there's a smell of soil everywhere. It's over your head, and it's impressive. It's like the one olfactory memory I have today. I can actually smell that soil as entering into this chamber. But the moment I entered this hallway into the main chamber, there was like a buzzing of 1,000 bees in my head. And I asked my daughter, can you hear that? And they hadn't heard it. And then I realized, you know, I think I've done something wrong, because only I'm hearing this intense buzzing in my ears, like bees. It was like bees, and I'm allergic to bees. So they're not my friends. I love them, but they're not my friends. So I knew these bees were being aggressive for a reason, and it hit me straight away. I was being punished for taking the rowan tree's fruit now in my pocket. So it's kind of an elegant way to punish me because I wasn't supposed to be taking them. My intention was to bring them back to Australia, very bad, and plant them here. But obviously that wasn't to happen. I was really quite frightened. And then I had a huge sense of guilt awakened in me. And then I knew straight away I had to return the rowan seeds to the place where I'd actually stolen them. But I was obliged to continue the tour, so down into this chamber. And the further I went, the more furious the buzzing became in my head. And she was, the guide, was giving this spiel about the winter solstice. So in the northern hemisphere, in the time closest to the end of the year, when the night's longer than the day, the dawn light of the solstice pierces to the centre chamber of Newgrange for 17 seconds and no longer. 17 seconds every solstice. That's incredible. So these, she's telling me this story. Meanwhile, the buzzing is happening in my head and I'm starting to perspire and I'm not knowing what's happening. I need to get outside and get rid of these fruit from the rowan tree. It seemed like an eternity, but finally we came outside and my sister and my daughter, and probably the rest of the group, looked on me curiously as I ran like a deer to the closest part of the rowan heads and with great care tossed all those fruit back into the leaves. And the moment the seeds left my hand, the buzzing stopped and I was calm again, completely stopped. So when I retold the experience, a lot of people made fun at my expense, but there it is. It is what happened. So I guess for me, the lesson of the gods is one firmly etched into my mind. So since that day at Newgrange, I've taken great care to take nothing from any sacred place and to never even unwittingly take anything that belongs there.
That's absolutely right. Always respect the ancient sites. Always. Anyone that knows anything to do with the occult, the rowan tree, the berries, it protects. I think it protects against black magic and witchcraft and that kind of thing.
Oh, okay. All right. So I was on the right track, or the buzzing was making me follow the right track.
Exactly. It makes plain sense. It was neoglyphic Newgrange, wasn't it?
Yes, it is. It is such an ancient site. I think it's close to 7,000 years old, am I right? Something like that. An incredible sight to behold. And given the fact that it's part of a network of granges in a way, so if you see it from the sky, there's much more than what we see on the ground.
Of course, yeah, and with all the chambers and that, fantastic. I think that's it's north of Dublin, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Very beautiful.
Very beautiful. If ever over that way, I'll pop a visit over there. I never got there. I do like the old sites.
Well, don't take any rowan tree seeds.
No, don't do that. Actually, it reminds me of I had a friend called Rob, and he was backpacking in Australia years ago, and he took a piece of Ayers Rock.
Yeah, Uluru? Yeah.
Uluru, sorry, yeah. And he took a piece of it and brought it back to the UK. And in a very short space of time, he broke his leg.
Oh.
His girlfriend left him. He lost his job. He was kicked out of his house.
Yeah.
So he posted that little bit of rock all the way back to Australia.
I bet he did. Oh, the ancients spoke.
And that is something I've heard from various different locations of the world. Never take anything that you shouldn't be taking.
Yeah, absolutely. And everyone, I think, globally should come and see Uluru. It's one of the seven wonders. I every time I see it, I cry. It's so magnificent and so sacred and remarkably and strangely dead center in this country. So it's very hard to explain why it's there. And of course, the people who manage the park around it will tell you lots of stories and about its sacredness.
It's a wonderful place, all right. Wonderful place. And it looks beautiful at sunset as well, with the lights and the colours.
Magnificent. Uluru is spectacular. All of Central Australia is spectacular. We were out there again recently seeing, some of the incredibly sacred spaces and gullies and creek beds and water holes just outside Alice Springs. Magnificent country.
Are you intrigued by Paranormal Talk Radio? You'll love the new Paranormal Radio app from TalkStream Live. You'll find a great selection of talk shows covering UFOs, ghosts, strange phenomena, and much more. Download the Paranormal Radio app now and start listening to the very best in paranormal talk entertainment, including the network you're listening to right now, the Paranormal Radio app, free in Google Play and the iOS App Store.
Minty, do you have any experiences from Australia?
I do. I was going to give you one more from Anley in Adelaide, when I lived in Adelaide, if you don't mind.
Be my guest.
Thank you, Nick. So I had a friend called Phil who was a geologist, and he was always renovating this spectacular old bluestone, they call it, bluestone house in Unley in Adelaide, which is in the south of Australia. And Unley is a very old suburb in terms of Australian white history. It's 1830s it was established. So some of the houses are spectacular. You know, they have pressed iron fireplaces and ceilings and beautiful glasswork. And the bluestone is quarried nearby. It's quite spectacular. And small verandas. A beautiful, beautiful house. So he was renovating his house. And he was going away as a geologist to the minefields of the Kimberleys and remote places in Western Australia. So a long way away. So he was always looking for someone to mine the house for him. So, you know, this time I put my hand up. Other times people, other friends put their hands up to look after the house. So several weeks, he'd be away for several weeks. So, you know, this time I said, sure, I'll look after it for you. You know, make sure I go over at least three times a week because I, you know, had my own place and was living there. And I had a little dog, a little terrier called Missy, and she was my constant companion. She came with me always to mind anybody's house where I stayed. And when Phil, my mate, gave me the keys before he jumped into the taxi and gave me a long list of instructions to called out to me, okay, sorry, I forgot, there's Fred, but don't worry about him, he's friendly. So I'm thinking, I had heard Fred mentioned before at parties at Phil's place, but I brushed it off as some kind of in-joke. I didn't know what it meant. So Phil winked at me and then jumped in and took off. So I thought, oh, Fred, maybe he's a nuisance-type neighbour or something, and maybe I'm going to come in contact with Fred and have to deal with him. But he wasn't a neighbour, and that's how I found out I was completely wrong. So the first night I came to stay at Phil's place, Missy, of course, my dog, was with me, and she was the one to notice something first. Before I even put the key in the door, there was a shadow behind the stained glass door. And I thought, well, that's odd. And then I put the key in the door and turned it, and meanwhile, Missy is whimpering and turning her head from side to side. And I pushed the door open. And as I entered, it was like a curtain of electricity entered my body. So I thought, phew, there's something here. And then Missy, my dog, wouldn't come in until I called her in. And then at some point, I had to like lift her over the lintel in a way. So that same night was the first of several nights when I woke up. I was sleeping in Phil's bed while he was away with a four-poster, beautiful bed in keeping with the house itself. I woke up to a dark shadow of a man standing at the foot of the bed. Again, I'm not particularly perturbed by spirits. You know, I think what scares me more are men with guns, but in real life. But, you know, spirits are there for a reason, I guess. And there he was, standing tall and didn't move. Missy was quite frightened. She crawled up towards me, up towards my head. And when I went to pat her and looked back again, he was gone. So then I discovered who this notorious Fred was. I assumed that's what Phil meant. So I took to letting, as I came into the house, I took to letting Fred know that I was actually there And I'd yell out, "Hi, Fred, how was your day?" and make conversation as I turned the key in the front door. And he always seemed pleased, and that kind of electric current, which passed through on the first night of entry, that lessened, has disappeared. So he was kind of pleased. I think we were company in a way. So I think Fred had been a sailor somehow. I don't know why I thought that, but I often smelt salt water really strongly, you know, the smell of the sea in the house. But we were a long way from the sea. Adelaide is on a gulf, but not actually sea. So the smell of salt water was really odd. So it didn't matter if there were other people in the house, you know, I'd have friends over and we'd have for dinner. Fred was always around. So he was one of those spirits who made noises in rooms in which you weren't. So if you were in the kitchen, he would make noises in the front area where people ate, where by the open chimney. He'd make noises like putting wood in the fire. So, and often people would say to me, "Is someone in the front room?" And I'd go, "Ah, no, that's Fred." And if we were all in the front room by the fire, you'd hear the drawers of the kitchen opening and shutting, opening and shutting. If I was in the bedroom, we could hear the shower running. That would be Fred, although nothing was wet. If I was in the shower, I could hear the door of the bedroom going. That was Fred. So I kind of got used to him. And other people, I guess, you know, took it on the chin. I was quite surprised nobody was too scared to ever come and visit. And Missy, my dog, actually got used to him. And I was kind of sad when Phil came back weeks later, in a way, that I had to kind of give up this unusual house.
Wonderful. How fascinating.
Yeah.
You have certainly got around a bit.
Yeah, I've been lucky. Lived in lots of unusual places and, you know, there's a lot. I guess in a way I'm really lucky and privileged to have unusual things happen to me. They don't bother me. Like I said, I'm not bothered by them. I just find them curious and they usually come out of the blue. And I got to a point where I just thought, I've got so many stories, I better put them into a book. So I do have a book where I put things and I usually give it to people, terrify them. To me, it's not terrifying. To me, it's almost like a second arm of life, the way it is. You know, there are other things out there than what we can touch and see and smell. There's other things.
Of course there is, and I'm glad you've written all these accounts down as well. What's the name of your book?
It's called Shadows Walking. You can get it from, you know, the usual places, Amazon, etc. But yeah, I'll put the link on the page if that's okay, Nick. Thanks.
We will put it down below, and we'll put it on the website as well, so people can check out. And I'm going to pick up a copy of it myself. I love the accounts like that, and wow. Fascinating.
Thank you so much, Nick. I love your show.
And I'm so glad you came on and shared. Obviously fascinating. And I'm starting to get more accounts from Colombia and Chile. I'm doing one from Chile at the minute. But that would
great.
Be that would be the first from China. Because I don't really have any listeners in China. But I know I do have a few because they listen on the old VPNs, so they bypass the internet via that way. Like, so I know I do have a few because I receive some emails. But that's the first actual experience I've had from China.
Well, that's good. I mean, you know, I think the great part of your show is that you hear people from all over. And what strikes me is there are quite significant cultural differences between countries, you know, in terms of levels of acceptance, you know, what we would call, you know, in a kind of an Anglo culture is paranormal is like next to nothing in South America. It's just like daily life, you know, it's not seen as odd, you know, it's just part of natural life and belief that there are extraordinary things that happen to you. And I think, you know, it's the story of China, that the same is true in China. It's just part of, you know, everyday life, this other plane.
It is. And I spent quite a lot of time in Southeast Asia. And Southeast Asia is the living and the dead. And it is all mixed into one. the daily practices of basically giving offerings to the past relatives and ancestors. I mean, it's a daily thing.
Yeah.
And it's the same throughout whole of Asia.
Yes, absolutely. And we, our daughter was living in Bandar Aceh in Indonesia. I saw a few things there too. And it's the same thing. They were the first town, city to be hit by the tsunami, that terrible tsunami. And I think 167,000 people died there. And everybody's stories are about the, you know, the living spirits. They're still there. You know, it's not like it's anything unusual. It's part of the culture to accept, as you say, death alongside life.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, that's how me and my wife met, because I was traveling around the world. I'd had my ticket booked and everything. This is in 2004. And then the tsunami struck on Boxing Day. So I changed my ticket and I went to work for a relief charity in Thailand. And my wife was at uni and she took time off and went down south to ID the bodies. And that's how we met. So
how incredible. So something so dreadful brought you together.
It was, yeah. And it was dreadful. I mean, it was very sad. I mean, I was predominantly doing like the cleanup and fixing up fishing boats and that kind of thing. And a lot of it was mostly done in June and July of that year.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, not all the bodies were found. A lot of them were swept out. And every now and again, a body would wash up. And it was, sometimes they were very young, some of the children. So it was very sad. And it is, you know, still a thing, unfortunately.
I guess, you know, and again, that's the difference, is what holds the collective heart together, I guess, in places like Indonesia and Thailand and through Southeast Asia, is as a result of, you know, after that terrible disaster, was, you know, this collective belief, as you say, that, you know, death and life exist together. And it's almost like a way to reconcile this terrible grief.
That's absolutely right. Every house over in Thailand, even like a spirit house, and it's like a beautiful birdhouse, the best way I can say it. And every single building and every single skyscraper that's in Bangkok has a spirit house. And the idea is for spirits, some place for the spirits to live. Because you don't want spirits to be wandering your house and stuff. And,
sure.
So that's the idea. So if you look at any property, any house, any hotel in Thailand, they all have a spirit house.
Wow.
And they give up.
I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure about Cambodia or Vietnam, but I know definitely Thailand has all these. And and they give offerings every day, an offering is given.
Yeah, well, it kind of makes sense, you know, like it's a way of also honouring your ancestors, so, and keeping them at bay so they don't invade the daily activity. I think it's a great idea.
Yeah, that's it. And it stops the wandering spirits. Obviously, Mute Lu, like black magic, is very, very prominent over there, a lot more than I thought it would be. It's very much a thing, and you have shaman and witch doctors which collect spirits in jars and all. Some of it is very, very, very deep and highly used as well. You have a lot of celebrities that go there from abroad as well, and they get these tattoos done and you name it. It's you'd think it'd be something of the past. You know, we've moved into the modern era, but no, it's still very much a thing.
Well, you know, at the end of the day, we're all primal creatures, you know, and I think what we've failed to do is maintain our connection to rituals like that, you know, ways to celebrate ancestors or death or, you know, the exceptional parts of life. I think we've lost it with too much modern living.
That's right, yeah. And I think a lot of it's also due with down to religion as well. Even though a lot of our festivals that we still celebrate are all pagan, you know, they're all pagan, they're all past ancient rituals and stuff.
Oh, yeah. I mean, name any one of them, they all fall on significant pagan dates.
Exactly, yeah. So a lot of people don't realize. So,
well, you know, maybe there'll come a time when we try and return a little bit more to just an ancient recognition of what's gone before us.
Yeah, yeah, especially when it comes to appreciating nature, you know, and celebrating nature. And I think that's another big thing that we've lost.
Yeah, I'm hopeful with newer generations that they get it. They get it better than we did, you know, and they do it better than we did. I'm hoping.
Yeah, fingers crossed. That's wonderful.
Lovely to speak with you, Nick.
I really appreciate you coming on and sharing all those wonderful accounts for us today.
I've really enjoyed it and it's taken me back. So I really appreciate it. I love your show. I love hearing other people's stories and the way that telling them affirms their stories. You know, I often hear people on your show saying, I know I'm not crazy or don't think I'm crazy. And I think, well, thank God for your show because they can tell stories where people will get it. They will understand.
And that's usually the subject title of most emails I receive. You're going to think I'm crazy.
Bit sad, really.
It is. But, you know, people come to the right place. You know, this is what the show's about is. It's just everyday people I have on here. You know, I don't really have many of the big names on TV or in the circuit of the paranormal UFOs. I avoid all them. It's not for them want of asking, but I say to them, you know, this show's about everyday people.
Yeah, and it really is. It's wonderful. And you're right. We're talking to people about things that they wouldn't tell other people, but in the anonymity of radio or podcasting, it's so good for them to feel like they've been validated.
Exactly. Yeah, because and someone will hear, I say this all the time, but someone will hear your account and they'll be like, I've experienced the same thing. Nobody believed me, you know? So and it snowballs.
Oh, no, you've done really well. I've listened to heaps of yours and I heard a Spaniard the other day and I heard, you know, someone from, I think a woman was talking about, you know, these exceptional experiences that she had with and where she'd been visited by, she thinks, you know, extraterrestrial beings. And then it repeated and repeated. And I think it was in Kentucky and it was worse. And I think it was so wonderful to hear her because you can hear the relief in her voice.
Yeah.
She's telling someone and she's not being, you know, diminished by telling it. She's being, you know, built up by telling it. It was wonderful.
Exactly, yeah. And people do get emotional and you can hear it in people's voices.
Yeah. It's relief or they're revisiting something. Yeah, it's incredible. Yeah, I love it. Thank you.
You're more than welcome. I really appreciate you coming on and sharing that for our listeners, okay?
Take care of yourself. Thank you, Nick. I do appreciate it. Be well.
Okay.
Ciao.
Bye-bye. Ciao for now. That is all for today. Keep updated and connected with the show on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And if you have an encounter that you'd like to share on the podcast, you can email me at ufochronicles@gmail.com or you can reach out to me via the contact page on my website at ufochroniclespodcast.com. A big thank you to Sergio and MimT for sharing tonight, and thank you all for listening. I will be back next week. Till then, stay safe and keep watching the skies. Goodbye.